Thank you very much. Thank you, President Marks. Good evening, class of 2013. 2013. Come on, give it up for yourself. It's a tremendous honor for me to be here with you tonight. Now, your parents are gone. Your stuff is unloaded. You've identified a few cute classmates you want to talk to. You're excited. You're nervous. I'm sure one of you already is drunk. But you're an amazing group. An amazing group. And I'm honored to be here to share a few of my thoughts with you tonight. I want to inspire you. I want to guide you. Most of all, I want to give you some advice. Advice to help you make the most out of your Amherst experience. Now, a friend told me that a few years from now, most people won't remember exactly what I said here today. They will only remember if I sucked or not. And they will remember if I was funny. So I'll be funny, even if only by accident. But you're now paying a lot of money to go to this school, and I think you deserve to be entertained a little bit. But I also hope I can share some lessons with you and inspire you a little bit. Now, it's ironic that this talk is coming from me, because I almost didn't get into Amherst. Nobody in my family had ever gone to college. I went to public school in New York. I had decent grades and marginal writing ability, but I definitely was on the edge. But I had a talent for running my mouth and slamming my 235-pound body into other large men at unreasonable speeds on the football field. But Amherst saw something in me. Amherst took a chance on me. Amherst invested in me. And now, Amherst is investing in each of you. So welcome to an amazing place, a unique place, and in my very biased opinion, the best college in America. You can give it up. Come on. Now, welcome to the place you've been reading so much about this summer. And welcome to the place named after the guy who's largely credited with creating biological warfare by distributing smallpox-infected blankets to Native American tribes in the area. Now, Lord Jeffrey Amherst is more than just, he's more than just a very similar-looking mascot to the New England Patriots' Pat the Patriot. Many of you, like me from New York, are going to really struggle with this throughout your 4 years, but Lord Jeffrey Amherst is our namesake and a mascot you will reluctantly explain to your non-Amherst friends forever. And welcome to the place that just this month, I found this out on the way up today. Just this month, Amherst was named the number 7 douchiest college in America by GQ magazine. You guys know this already. Okay. He didn't know. You guys knew. Okay, for real. I'm not making this up. According to GQ, Amherst is the home of the, quote, I went to a small liberal arts college in Massachusetts, douche. Now, the affectations... a quiet sense of superiority, an intense desire to be surrounded by 1,700 people almost exactly like you, choked soccer jackets. And according to GQ, in 10 years, you will be a smart policy person at the State Department that no one listens to. The douchey mascot, of course, the Lord Jeffrey Amherst. The problem with the douchey mascot, and this was in GQ, distributed smallpox-infected blankets to Native Americans. Now, GQ may not be a big fan of Amherst, but I am. I love this place, and I was extremely honored to go to school here. Sat in these very seats. It seems like a long time ago, but it was a beautiful day like this when I got here. But my path was extremely unlikely. And let me tell you a little more. My senior year, Coach E.J. Mills, the head of the football team, was showing a prospective student, a football recruit, around the alumni gym with his parents. So he introduced the recruit to me and a few other seniors. We were football players at Amherst, and I was a senior. We were equally impressive with our multiple extracurricular activities, soon-to-be-published theses, acceptance to prestigious law and medical schools, and pending six-figure jobs on Wall Street. Each of us was about to fulfill our Amherst potential and take our rightful place at the real-world table of the Masters of the Universe. Now, at that point, I was the student government president. I had a big job on Wall Street, and I was contemplating some crazy idea of joining the Army. But despite all that, I really didn't know what the hell I was doing with my life, but I looked pretty good on paper. So me and my friends were an example of what this young kid could be if he attended Amherst. So we chatted him up and we talked to his parents about why we loved Amherst and seemed to make a pretty good impression. After the kid and his parents left, Coach Mills thanked us, came back and was talking to us, and we asked him, you know, Coach, tell us about the kid's prospects for attending Amherst. You know, competition was high and it was a very tough year for admission. Coach Mills told us the kid had a pretty good chance of getting admitted, but it was close, very close. One of the guys in our group, an underclassman, said something along the lines of, hey, Coach, I bet you had no problem getting Rykoff in 4 years ago. Mills smirked, and he didn't miss a beat. Rykoff? I couldn't get Rykoff into Amherst with a catapult now. That's true. But we all laughed. He was right. In 1993, Amherst took a chance on me, and I'm forever grateful. And I spent every day I went to Amherst showing people that the chance they took on me was worth it. And I owe Amherst. I never stop appreciating how fortunate I was to go here. But whether you got in through early admission or via the waiting list, you're privileged to be here too. And I hope you do appreciate that. Appreciate it every day. One of my best friends in the world, Todd Bowers, right now is serving in the Marine Corps in the mountains of eastern Afghanistan. He's a 29-year-old staff sergeant on his fourth deployment since 9/11. In 2006, during the Battle of Fallujah, he was shot in the face by a sniper, but miraculously he survived. And we talk on the phone whenever we can, and they're tough calls, really tough calls. But every time we end, he says to me, listen, man, eat all you can, drink all you can, have some for me since I can't have any. But live every day like it's your last, because it might be. Carpe diem. Seize the day. That's what Bauer says, and what many of us who have served in combat learn, and what many people who've lived through crisis of any kind learn, that life is short, so you better maximize every day. And that's my recommendation for you while you're here at Amherst, not just today, but every day. 4 years are going to be gone in a flash, and before you know it, you'll be back in this room as an alum for a reunion event, yelling at President Marks about something or other that has the potential to ruin our fair college on the Hill forever. Now, I was in Iraq for about a year, and many of you read my book, so you know that story. Some of you did not read my book, and you'll fake it right now. More proof that you'll do well here at Amherst. But while I was in Iraq, I often missed the things back home a ton. I missed my family. I missed watching live music in New York City. I missed the ocean. I missed Krispy Kreme donuts. I missed air conditioning. But often, I missed Amherst, because Amherst really is one of my favorite places in the world. I missed the energy of the first week back at school. I missed the concentration of very smart people in one place. I missed the smell in the quad after it rained. I missed being a student. I missed being in a place where I could focus on my studies and explore the world and my place in it. So in writing this talk, I thought about the things I wanted to make sure you didn't miss while you were here. So I talked to a good number of Amherst grads over the summer, and I asked for their recommendations. I asked them what kind of advice they would give the incoming freshman class. I got some good ones, and I got some that I can't repeat here. But I came up with a list of 50 things about Amherst you should know or make sure you know while you're here over the course of your 4 years. I worried about listing them off and whether you'd remember them a few years from now, but I realized this whole thing will likely be on YouTube tonight anyway. And maybe one or two of you is actually live-tweeting the whole thing. So without further ado, in no particular order, here's my list of the 50 things you should do while you're a student at Amherst. Number one. It'll go quick, Tony, don't worry. Number one, see lots of live music. Lots of live music. Go to a concert at the Iron Horse. Live music in the Valley is solid. Over the course of my 4 years, I saw everyone from Dave Matthews to Run DMC to the Roots to the Fugees, all right here in the Valley. Run DMC played in the Campus Center. Number two, take a class at UMass, Holyoke, Hampshire, or Smith. Number three, go to a party at each of them too, especially Hampshire, preferably on Halloween. It's pretty weird. Number four, eat at Antonio's Pizza. That'll likely happen without me telling you this, but this speech is sponsored by Antonio's. I work at a nonprofit. I have to pay the bills. Number five, take a class with Professor Serrett and Professor Arkes. I was a poli-sci major, so I'm a bit biased, but I think it's a must. See if you can get them to debate each other or even fight each other. I tried and never succeeded. Number six, watch the stars from the roof of the Octagon building. It's not easy to get to. There's a little railing you have to climb over. But the view is spectacular. My apologies to the head of campus security for that one. I'll show you how to do it, Tony. Number seven, learn about Robert Frost. Read his work. Number eight, check out the Emily Dickinson Museum. And number nine, go sledding down Memorial Hill. Try it on a food tray from Valentine Dining Hall. I never got that one to work, but I'm a pretty big dude, and those trays are pretty small. But still, you should try it. Number 10, try to meet some members, if you can, of the Hurricane Class of 1938. September 21st, 1938, a huge hurricane hit this campus. More than 60,000 people in the area had their homes destroyed. 9,000 homes and buildings were totally destroyed. 2 billion trees were wiped out. The estimated cost at the time was $6.2 million, which translates today to about $15 billion. The fury of the rain and the wind struck the campus with major destructiveness. Buildings shook. The roof of the Morrill Dormitory was actually ripped off. 140 trees on campus were uprooted and destroyed, and almost 400 trees in the wildlife sanctuary were uprooted or broken. But the Amherst community rallied. They bound together, and they rebuilt this campus. And that's why the class of 38 is called the Hurricane Class. Number 11, learn about President John F. Kennedy's speech here. On October 26, 1963, dedicating Robert Frost Library, just a month before he was assassinated, President Kennedy spoke here. And he said, "And what good is a private college or university unless it's serving a great national purpose? The library being constructed today, this college itself, all of this, of course, was done not merely to give this school's graduate an advantage, an economic advantage in life's struggle. It does that. But in return for that, in return for the great opportunity which society gives the graduates of this and related schools, it seems to me incumbent upon this and other schools' graduates to recognize their responsibility to the public interest. Therefore, I am proud to come to this college whose graduates have recognized this obligation and say to those that are now here that the need is endless, and I am confident that you will respond." And then President Kennedy quoted Robert Frost, who said, "The two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." Number 12, find out about all the notable people who went to Amherst. You've heard about some of them, but they range from President Calvin Coolidge to author Scott Turow to Supreme Court Justice Harlan Fiske Stone to Teller from Penn and Teller, although I'm not sure which one that is. Sex therapist Dr. Drew. No, somebody's excited. Nobel Prize winning economist Joe Stieglitz to actor Burgess Meredith. Burgess Meredith was the Penguin from the old Batman TV show. You guys may not have seen that, but you may know him as Mickey, the old guy from the Rocky movies, who said, "Get up, you son of a bitch, because Mickey loves you." Yeah, that guy went to Amherst. Lots of amazing people went here. But no, President Barack Obama did not go here. He couldn't get in. But maybe he should have. Number 13, go to an event at every theme house on campus, even if you don't believe in theme houses. I lived in Drew House for 2 years, and it was fantastic. Go to a party at the zoo. Go to the full moon party. That's very cool, too. Number 14, Tony, you're not going to like this one. Find out where the tunnels are. There are tunnels under this campus. Shh. There are tunnels under this campus. Try to get into them without getting caught. Again, my apologies to campus security. Jeez, I'm going to be the first orientation day speaker to be responsible for getting an entire class to graduate with a criminal record. Or at least the first class since the 60s. Which reminds me, number 15. Learn about how the senior class in 1966 protested Defense Secretary Robert McNamara's speech at graduation during the Vietnam War. The seniors famously wore black armbands to protest his talk. In his later years, McNamara wrote about it. He said, "What disturbed me most during my campus visits was the realization that opposition to the administration's Vietnam policy increased with the institution's prestige and educational attainment of its students. At Amherst, those protesting my presence wore armbands. I counted the number and calculated the percentages of protesters in each of four groups: graduates, cum laude graduates, magna cum laude graduates, and summa cum laude graduates. To my consternation, the percentages rose with the level of academic distinction." There's a proud tradition of political activism, involvement, engagement, of social responsibility here at Amherst, and I challenge you to uphold that tradition. Number 16, check out a club sport. Playing rugby was one of the most fun things I ever did, changed my life, and I made some great friendships. Number 17, yeah, okay. You play rugby with me? No? Number 17, do a semester overseas somewhere. I didn't do it, and I regret it. If you don't speak a language, that's no excuse. You go to Amherst now, and you can fake it. Number 18, learn the words to the Lord Jeffrey Amherst song. It's a really fun song to sing at football games. It's old, but it's good. And if you don't like it by the end of 4 years, maybe one of you can create a remix with Jay-Z, T-Pain, and Lady Gaga. Number 19, find out which of the five characters of Scooby-Doo represents each of the five colleges here in the Valley. You'll learn about that one. Number 20, get to know the people who work at this college. Not just the professors, but the people who work in Valentine, the people who cut the lawns, the people who clean the floors. They're some of the most amazing people here, and they're the ones that really run this place. No offense, President Marks. Number 21, get to know your professors. That's a unique thing to Amherst. You can really get to know your professors. Spend time with them. Go to see them during office hours. That's something I didn't do nearly enough of when I was here. And take a course where you get to take a class in a professor's house. That's a great thing about Amherst, and the professors have some pretty dope houses. Number 22, read the names on the war memorial at the top of Memorial Hill. Many Amherst students were lost in World War I and World War II, and their names are still on that hill. Number 23, check out the radio station, 89.3 FM, WAMH Radio in Amherst. They'll let almost anyone have a show. They let me have a show. Number 24, watch Animal House, the movie. Watch Animal House. It's a classic. But does anyone know what phony name Otter uses to introduce himself at the Women's College? Frank Lyman. Good effort. He introduces himself as Frank Lyman from Amherst College. Number 25, work at Reunion. Every year, the classes that have graduated before you come back for Reunion, be a bartender. The tips are good, and the stories are priceless. That's how I found out about the hurricane class. Number 26, find out where the Quabbin Reservoir is and go swimming there with somebody you care about. It's a very cool spot. Number 27, go watch a sport you've never seen live before. For me, squash, water polo, fencing, all a first for me. For some of you, Quidditch may do. Quidditch, yeah, they play Quidditch here. It's a must-see. Got to warn you, it ain't pretty. Number 28, write. Write. Write not just for your professors, but for yourselves and for your grandchildren. Every single one of you has something to say, and Amherst is the place for you to hone your voice. If you're not a good writer, do not run away from it. Work it out here. This is the place to do it. Document your stories. Share your experiences. Twitter and Facebook don't count. Do it for yourself. Do it for each other. But do it for your grandkids. Write. 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 Number 29. Learn about the first class of women admitted at Amherst. The first women admitted as first-year students arrived at Amherst in the fall of 1976 as members of the class of 1980. Believe it or not, Amherst only went co-ed a little over 30 years ago. Number 30, take an art class. I took screenwriting, acting, and Afro-Caribbean dance and music, one of my most memorable courses. Number 31, share Amherst with your family. They're proud of you. Let them enjoy it, even if you have to make them. Some events like graduation, it's as much for them as it is for you. Number 32, take care of each other. When you see someone struggling over the course of your 4 years, pick them up. If you see someone drunk on Route 9, also pick them up. But take care of each other. Integrity is doing the right thing, even when no one is looking. Some of the friends you make here will be your friends forever. Some of you have met people this weekend that will one day walk in your wedding. Serve as mentors for your children. Trust me. Some of you will get married. But they will walk in your wedding. They will serve as mentors to your children. And some of them will speak at your funeral. But take care of each other and get to know each other. Number 33, take care of yourself and find an oasis. There are going to be hard times while you're here at Amherst. Not every day is going to be sunshine and puppies. You're going to have financial problems, academic problems, family problems, love problems, but you can get through it. But you got to take care of yourself. Find your oasis to get you through those hard times. It might be a spot on campus. It might be a favorite book. It might be an important song. But I learned in Iraq that when things get tough, you got to find an oasis, a safe place where you can take a protected break to get your bearings before you get back in the game. Number 34, write a letter to the editor of the student newspaper about something you're passionate about. If you can't find anything in 4 years that motivates you enough to write a letter, you need to spend less time with the bomb. Number 35, it's true. It's true. 35, enjoy the facilities. For all you folks that play sports, you're going to spend a ton of time in that nice gym. And remember, for all you folks that want to bulk up, you're going to spend 4 years trying to put that weight on and the rest of your life trying to get it off. Number 36, now from time to time, this is another tradition you may not be aware of. UMass kids come down here to battle you after the first snowfall of the year. Kick their ass. Now, they may have the numbers, but remember, this is the place that invented biological warfare. And some kid here probably has his own private army. Number 37, go to the room that the Prince of Monaco lived in here at Amherst. It was in James or Stearns, it might be gone now, but find out where it was. It was like an Amherst version of Cribs. It was pretty sick. Number 38, check out the bird sanctuary. Not too many schools have one of those. I never saw a bird sanctuary until I came to Amherst. Number 39, get out of the bubble. Get out of the bubble. This place is amazing. Fantastic. You're going to hear a lot of reasons why it's like nothing else in the world. But it is a bubble. So keep your perspective. Stay connected to the outside world and the struggles of the people in your country and in the rest of the world. Take a trip to Springfield, Holyoke, or New York from time to time just for a break. Amherst can get pretty stressful, but make sure you get out and you keep your perspective. Read the paper, travel, talk to people off campus, but guard against the bubble. Number 40, get to know some alumni. Talk to them when they come back for homecoming. Seek out people who work in an industry you're interested in. The alumni of Amherst are an incredibly dynamic, loyal, dedicated group of people, and they look out for their own. The people I work with jokingly call my Amherst network the Illuminati. But reach out to them and be persistent, which brings me to another short story I want to share with you. So early in my junior year, I'm exploring all kinds of things. I want to be proactive, right? I wanted to get a cool internship. I'm looking at Wall Street, law school, Peace Corps, and the CIA. CIA. Thought that sounded pretty cool. Maybe I'd watched too many movies, but I thought being a CIA agent would be a pretty good job. And an internship, that'd be a good place to start, right? So I went down to the Career Center. That's the place that's supposed to help you figure out what the hell to do with your life, or connect you with people who can help you figure out what the hell to do with your life. Well, anyway, I went down to the Career Center, poke around a little bit, and this was before everything was online, and the Career Center had these huge white binders filled with contact information for thousands of Amherst graduates. If you looked up medicine, there were huge white binders full of people who worked in medicine. You could find alum the year they graduated, where they lived, what they did. So I started looking for folks who worked at the CIA, and I found a few. Now, the Career Center had pretty strict rules. You weren't supposed to call these people directly. You were supposed to send a letter or go through some complicated paperwork process. So I copied the names down and went down to my room and started making some phone calls. Didn't get much. I left a few messages. Hey, my name is Paul Rykoff, class of 98 at Amherst. Yeah, I see you went to Amherst and you work at the CIA. I was hoping I could chat with you a little bit about your work, maybe come down and have a cup of coffee or lunch. Made about a dozen phone calls, but mostly I just left messages. You know, a few numbers had been disconnected. I really didn't get much. So I went off to football practice that night, then went to dinner, came back to my room to do some studying, and the phone rang. I picked up the phone and said, hello. The voice on the other end of the line said slowly and sternly, who is this? Who is this? You called me. Who is this? I'm still from New York. I'm going to ask you again. Who is this? You called me today, and I want to know who this is. Oh, this is Paul Rykoff. I was happy. I'm a junior at Amherst, and I was hoping I could get some advice, and I made a few phone calls. You know, who is this, please? Silence. He sounded pissed. This was not going well. So much for the Amherst alums being helpful and all that, right? How did you get my number? And how did you get my home number? Oh, it was easy. I just went down to the Career Center, and it said you worked at the CIA, and I'm interested in the CIA, and I thought I'd drop you a line. Really? Do you know who I am? My name is John Deutsch. Sir? No, sir. I just had your name. It said you worked at the CIA. I'm the director of the CIA. Drink water while you're giving a speech. That's not in the list. He said, I'm the director of the CIA. You called my house. You mean to tell me my home phone number is listed in the Career Center at Amherst? Yes, sir. I'll have to deal with that. Don't call here again, please. And he hung up. Well, I never called him again. Never ended up meeting him, but it did teach me a lesson about the powerful Amherst alumni network. I probably got someone who works in the Career Center extradited to a black site or Guantanamo, but I never did hear from him again. So, needless to say, I never got an internship at the CIA. But reach out to the alumni network. They're loyal and they're happy to help you, but I highly recommend you Google them first. Now back to the list. Number 41, check out the James Joyce bathroom here in Johnson Chapel. Don't do it all at once right after this talk, but you have 4 years. Check it out. Number 42, get used to explaining that you go to Amherst College, not UMass. That's the big state school up the street. Nice place, but that's not where you go to school. For me, folks usually look at me and go, you went to Amherst? You mean UMass? No, Amherst College. Really? Yeah. Huh. Before I was accepted, nobody in my family had even heard of Amherst. So I was concerned, and I told an older guy who had gone to Harvard like 100 years before, and he told me something that is so true even to this day. He said, Paul, not everyone knows about Amherst, but the people who you really want to know about Amherst, they know about Amherst. People who know education, people in business and science, they know about Amherst. Speaking of which, number 43, learn how to say the name of your new college properly. It's Amherst. No H. It's a common freshman mistake. People will correct you, but save them the trouble. I'm still trying to get my dad to say it properly. He still says, yeah, my kid goes to Amherst. Number 44, give back to Amherst. It won't be hard on the money side. You should prepare for a lifetime of emails, letters, phone calls from Amherst College asking you for money. The constant flood of solicitations would put the Obama campaign and MoveOn.org to shame. But there's an old saying that the two things are certain in life, death and taxes for Amherst grads. There's a third, nonstop calls for money from our dear college on the Hill. But as you do prepare for those calls, remember that many of you can afford to go here now because others that came before you gave back. So give back to Amherst. Give your time, give your energy, give your talent, but give something back to Amherst. Number 45, beat Williams. Yeah. Do it, because losing to them sucks. And whether it's a debate match or a basketball game, it sucks. So just beat them good, beat them always. Number 46, get involved. Get involved. Get involved in your own education, in politics, in the way this college moves going forward. You are the lifeblood of this institution. And if you don't get involved, someone else will be more than happy to speak for you. So get involved. Number 47, make a difference. This speech is supposed to be a life of consequence. Well, make your life one of consequence. And you can do that in part by making a difference in the lives of others. No matter what you do, you need to serve. President Marx talked about it earlier. But you do have an obligation to your families, to yourselves, to this college, and to your world. And we need you to serve. And that's not just in the Marine Corps. It could be in the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps teaching, but we need you to serve. Now, I'm not telling you not to go out and make money. If you decide to do that, go for it. But no matter what you do, I'm asking you to remember to build into yourself and into your education here at Amherst a sense of social responsibility. Bob Dylan said once that a hero is someone who understands the responsibility that comes with his freedom. You have tremendous responsibility and tremendous opportunity, but make a difference. Number 48, enjoy every day. I talked about this earlier, but 4 years goes by pretty fast. Enjoy every day of it, even the crappy ones. I was here over 10 years ago, which seemed like a different century. We weren't allowed to have cars on campus as freshmen then either. It sucked then. I'm sure it still sucks now. But you have Zipcar, which does not suck. We didn't have that when I was here. We didn't have Wi-Fi. We didn't have cell phones either. I had this antiquated thing you've probably never even heard of called an answering machine. A few cool kids actually had a beeper. Yeah, a beeper. You probably don't even know what those looks like. But my point is that before you know it, you'll be back here talking to a bunch of young people about what it was like when you went here. It goes by fast, so enjoy every day and make the most of it. And we need you. Your country needs you. The world needs you. And the world has never needed you so much. We need your creativity, your intelligence, your passion, your heart. You're an amazing group of engaged, brilliant, driven people. You are the post-9/11 generation. After World War II, the generation that came home and was so impacted by war and depression grew to become the greatest generation. Well, you could be, you should be, the next greatest generation. Number 49, be a leader. We need you to be leaders. Leaders in science, education, entertainment, medicine, politics, the arts, and yes, maybe even the military. But there's a saying in the military, keep running to the sounds of the guns. It applies to the need for leadership in times of crisis and to life more broadly. Go to where the action is. Go to where you're needed. Go to where your leadership is required. Make a difference. Now, in the military, I have met some heroes, but I've met plenty of heroes in other places as well. Now, these are important, turbulent times. And America needs you. Barack Obama's president, and that's definitely a change. But everything is not okay just because we have a new president. The world needs you out in front more than ever. The wars, the economy, foreign policy, disease, Katrina, the environment. I learned in the Army that good leaders lead from the front. Sometimes it's lonely, often it's hard, but always lead by example and lead from the front in whatever you do. A few years back, then President Bush said the Iraq War was the fight of our generation. I thought he was wrong, and I said so right here at Amherst. And I think he's more wrong now. The fight of our generation, the fight of your generation, is not the Iraq War. The fight of our generation is rebuilding and repairing the world after tremendous challenges like the Iraq War. rebuilding our economy, saving our planet, helping the people in Iraq, Afghanistan, and America who've been devastated by war, creating peace in the Middle East, repairing America's image abroad. That's your fight. That's the good fight. That's the fight of your generation, and we need you leading this fight. Whether you study art or you study Arabic, you must join us in improving our world. Crisis offers opportunity, and your generation has been issued a historic call, and you must answer that call. The leader is the one who steps up, and that is what we need you to do. Never doubt for a second that every single day of your life, you have a chance to change the world. You just have to make the leap. Teddy Roosevelt had a great quote that I found. Far better it is to dare mighty things, to win glorious triumphs, even though checkered by failure, than to rank with those poor spirits who neither enjoy nor suffer much because they live in the gray twilight that knows neither victory or defeat. Take that road less traveled that Robert Frost wrote about, not just at Amherst, but throughout your life. And last on my list, number 50, bring the light. Bring the light. Terrace irradiant. Let them give light unto the world. That's the Amherst motto. Bring that light onto the world. That's what I want you to leave with. Bring the light. And that doesn't mean the sun shines out of your ass. Even though, as the chosen ones, it may sometimes seem as though it does. It means that every generation of Amherst graduates all the way back to the 1800s has brought light onto the world. Every single class has done it. And you will too. You'll bring the light. You'll bring tremendous light to Amherst and to the world. Class of 2013, we're proud of you, and we expect big things from you. Thank you for this amazing opportunity to speak with you, and that's my list of 50 things you should do at Amherst. Welcome to Amherst College. Thank you.
Is ready for your questions. This is Amherst. Don't hold back.
I did the hard part. Come on. Where are you? Please. I saw somebody just. I'm sorry. There you are. Go ahead, please. Apparently, you're going to have to show President Marx where the tunnels are. Questions? I saw somebody pointing. Help me out, guys. Okay, yes, please. Realizing I wasn't going to play pro? Other questions? Yes, sir. What inspired me to write the book? The same thing that inspired me to start Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the same thing that made me run for student government when I was here, I got pissed off. I saw something that I thought was wrong in the world that I had something to say about. I wanted people to understand the soldier's perspective. You had heard from policy wonks and from the president and from four-star generals, but you hadn't really heard from that young man or woman that was walking in the streets of Iraq and this subject that so many people around the world were talking about. So when I got back, I saw that folks didn't really understand what I had gone through and what my soldiers had gone through. And those 38 guys that came home, they got me home. You know, I'm indebted to them forever too. But it was just something in my gut, a fire that I had something to say. And it was originally letters. It was letters back home to my girlfriend, and I never really thought about writing a book, but other folks encouraged me and showed me that I had a voice, and I had to stitch those letters together into a book, and I think that, you know, everybody's got a book in them, and I encourage you to write. It doesn't have to be a manifesto. It can be a short story or an experience that you had, but writing a book was one of the hardest experiences I've ever had. It was harder than Iraq in many ways. It was harder than Amherst in many ways, but writing a book was an incredibly challenging thing for me. Yeah, go ahead. What advice for your friend? Talk to as many people like me as you can. You know, talk to as many people who've been there, not just me specifically, but as many people who've been there before. And somebody gave me a bit of advice before I left, and I think it applies to any tough situation you know you're going into. He said, find beauty every day. Find beauty every day. No matter how bad it gets, no matter how rough the place is that you're in, you can find beauty somewhere. It can be the smile of a child. It can be a sunset. It can be a firefly. It can be something. But those little moments of beauty can get you through the tough times. Yeah. Yes, sir. I'm going to repeat the questions in case you guys can't hear them. What challenges did I face starting a nonprofit? I'm glad you asked that because I didn't know when I was sitting where you are that you could make a difference in the world and make a living. I didn't know the word, you know, the term social entrepreneurship. So building a nonprofit was incredibly challenging. We had no money. We had no resources. We didn't know anybody really of influence. So it was really tough building a movement, really a social movement from scratch. But we had tremendous generosity from people inside the veterans community and outside the veterans community. But I think the hardest part about writing a book, starting a nonprofit, is that first step. You got to go. You got to just do it. You got to start moving forward. You're going to have mistakes along the way. You're going to have bumps. But the hardest part is really making that first move to decide you're going to do it. It's going to take turns, and it may not be what you thought it was going to look like at the end. But that first step is usually the hardest part. And that's where folks are going to tell you, hey, you need to go make money first, or you need to go to grad school first, or you need to do this first. If you think you're ready for it, go for it. Even if other folks don't believe it. If you believe it in your heart that it's the right thing to do or it's the right thing for you to do, you need to do it. Yes, please. No, go for it. You won't be this shy in 4 years. Yeah, it's a good question. What made me want to go to Iraq? I wanted to serve. I wanted to give something back, and I didn't agree with the war in Iraq. I thought it was a terrible decision. I thought it was potentially the worst foreign policy decision in our country's history. But I also didn't think that staying home protesting in Union Square would allow me to make a difference. And I didn't think that going to a jail cell, which would at some point be my other option, would be a way for me to make a difference to my maximum. Going to Canada or something like that. I realized that on the ground in Iraq with 38 people under my command, I could influence that scope of the world. And sometimes that meant minimizing civilian casualties. Sometimes that meant rebuilding a school. Sometimes that meant repairing a marriage. But there are plenty of kids in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there were at that time, who were from Mississippi State or were from UMass or from other places. And I feel that folks like Amherst folks were really underrepresented. And there was a whole convoluted, jumbled series of reasons why I went. But that's where, at that time, I thought I could make the biggest difference. Yes, sir. Yeah, I don't regret joining the military at all. You know, there's an old saying that you don't get to pick which wars you fight. And being in the military taught me a ton, made me a stronger person. I have tremendous friendships and a perspective on the world that I wouldn't otherwise have. And I think that given my background now, I have an opportunity to change the way our military is utilized, the way our country looks at force, the way that our country looks at war and the consequences of war. You know, there's an old saying that nobody hates war more than the warriors, and I think that that's true. So I don't regret my decision to join the military. I regret that George Bush sent my ass over there, but I don't regret my decision to join at all. Yes, sir, in the back. Oh, sure. Did I face criticism from other veterans? When I came back here to speak in 2004, I'll never forget that Ben Lieber, the dean of students, and I met, and I was in uniform. And it had been a long time since someone came back to Amherst to speak in uniform. And I was at the Octagon, and I asked Ben, you know, how are they going to receive me? You know, am I going to get hit with tomatoes? Am I going to get hit with eggs? But this community was supportive. A bunch of people came in with an open mind, and they wanted to hear what I had to say. And I found that group incredibly important and inspiring and supportive. But a lot of vets had a major problem with what I was saying at that time. I mean, back when I was here in 2004, when I said we didn't have body armor, that was considered a controversial thing. Now it's common knowledge. When I said that the insurgency was growing, people said, why are you supporting the terrorists? I mean, it was a very different time. 2004 was a very polarized country. So I took a lot of social heat rounds. A lot of folks had a lot to say about what I was doing. But over time, the support grew, and I realized that I wasn't alone, and that other voices came out and said, you know, we have similar concerns with the direction of our country, with the direction of our foreign policy. So it was lonely at times. I mean, I had death threats and people calling my grandmother's house and all kinds of craziness. But in the end, I made it through it, and I hope it made a difference. I'll go up top. Anybody? Yes, sir. Have I ever considered running for office? You know, I spend a lot of time in Washington, and it's not a job I want right now. Being in Congress, in my opinion, sucks, especially with two-year terms where you've got to constantly raise money, and you're really, you know, a function of this political machine. You don't get enough time to read and to write and to think and to engage with people. So being in Congress is really not a job that I think will utilize the best of my abilities. I'm not living in Brooklyn anymore. Now I'm in the East Village, but I also don't like Washington. I don't like wearing a suit. I mean, I didn't get the memo that it was like shorts and t-shirts. But you know, same as always, I'm trying to figure out the best place to make a difference. And for me right now, being a junior congressman from New York is not the same impact that I can have with this organization where we're developing and cultivating a generation of really important young leaders from all backgrounds, from all political stripes that are trying to impact the direction of this country and to take care of each other. That's really what our work is about now, is about taking care of our own and trying to make a difference. Let me go in the back. Hooded sweatshirt. Yes, sir. My most rewarding experience, what? From Iraq. You guys don't want to talk about Amherst, do you? You're Amherst-ed out. I think the 24 hours. The most rewarding experience of Iraq was really the day I left. Like when I got on that plane and I looked around and I said, everybody's here. You know, we came over with 38. We're leaving with 38. And 38 of America's sons were going home safely. That was my greatest satisfaction. I mean, there was also points where I think we made a real difference for the local community, especially for the children. There are a lot of bad things that happened, too. But, you know, the impact we were able to have on a very small level with some of the kids was really satisfying and rewarding for me, and was some of that beauty that I had to find in a hard time. But, you know, coming home and kissing the ground and getting a Krispy Kreme and a cold Diet Coke, that was damn good. Yes, in the back behind the post. Am I in touch with the people that went with me to Iraq? Was that your question? Yeah, I am. I am. I'm in pretty regular touch with them. American and Iraqi. Some of you who read deeper into my book found out that one of my interpreters, Isam Pasha, now is here in the States and lives in Connecticut. Another one of my interpreters and a dear friend of mine, Mohammed, is now living in Nashville, Tennessee, of all places. But he got here safely to the U.S., and he's now starting a new life for his family. So I'm in touch with him, and I am in touch with a lot of the guys that I served with. Some of them are back over there now. You know, we've had a lot of hard times since we've got back. One guy unfortunately committed suicide. We've had a real hard knock on a lot of the families, but you're never as close as the day the last day you were together. It's a lot like Amherst, I think. And the last day you're here, you're all going to scatter to the four winds, and you'll never be together like you were here. But they're an amazing group of guys, and I was honored to serve with them. Yes, right there with the glasses.
You dislike the decision to go into Iraq, but you love this country and its soldiers. If you were president
Whoo, now we're getting into amorous type questions. If you were king for a day, how would you fix everything? No, I like the question. Talking about Iraq specifically, I mean, I could teach a whole course on this, I guess. I don't have enough time, to be honest with you. Like, I don't want to give you a BS answer. I think that you know, the drawdown makes sense. We can't sustain what we've been doing over there for this long. Whether or not the Iraqi military is ready, I don't think anyone knows. I think that everything in Iraq is incredibly dynamic and can change on a dime. And I'm not just trying to be vague. I mean, I think the timetable as it stands right now makes sense. But you can't look at Iraq in an isolated situation. It's a piece of a larger puzzle that includes Pakistan and Afghanistan and the entire region, Iran. I mean, it's just an incredibly complicated equation. But I think that President Obama is on the right track with Iraq, and it is a dramatic difference from what we had in the last administration. But the one thing I would tell you all regarding that is keep paying attention. I think a lot of folks in this country have forgotten there are two wars going on, and it's hard for us to get attention for the plight of veterans, the plight of the Iraqi civilians, the plight of folks in the Middle East. So stay engaged and keep reading and keep writing and keep watching what's happening over there, because it's very important. Yes, sir, blue shirt. It's a good question. How did I deal with taking lives in Iraq? Ultimately, for me and my soldiers, it was a cost-benefit analysis. I hate to say it that way, but we had a reality that if we didn't take some lives, we would lose our own. And ultimately, my mission over there wasn't about George Bush. It wasn't about the Middle East. It wasn't really about Iraq. For me, it was about getting those 38 guys home safely. And civilian casualties and folks dying on the battlefield is something I hope most of you never have to experience. But I'm still dealing with it every day. I don't think you ever get done dealing with it. Yes, sir, in front. Woo, man, my thoughts on conscription. I think there's a major problem with the fact that our country is not at war, our military is at war. There's no social backstop. So most people are experiencing what someone has called patriotism light. It's like, yeah, go bomb them with somebody else's kids. So I think we have to find a way to re-engage the American public in foreign policy. I don't think that a draft is probable, but it's not impossible. And I think that's something everybody should think about. If the balloon goes up and something happens in Korea and there are other places, we may be called upon to serve. So don't think that because you're not in the military, you're immune or you're isolated from what's happening in foreign policy. But if it's something you feel strongly about, get involved. Get involved. I think we've had like six guys in a row. Yes, ma'am, up there. That question usually comes sooner. Am I still with my girlfriend from the book? No, I'm not. I'm not. We're not together anymore, but she's doing really well, and she's still playing music, and we stay in touch from time to time. But unfortunately, no, we're not. In the back. Yes, sir. Talk to me afterward. No, honestly, there have been a lot of folks who have thought about joining the military after Amherst. And it's a small enough network. There's very few of us, as Tony talked about earlier. So talk to us, and let's talk to you about it. I'm not here to sell you on the military, not at all, by any means. But you know, if it's the right decision for you, you have to arrive at that decision, and don't just buy a recruiter's line. You know, sit down and talk to folks who've been there and make your judgment for yourself. But that's my best piece of advice, is talk to folks who've been there. And talk to folks who've come from elite colleges and gone there. There's a great book by a guy named Nate Fick, who went to Dartmouth and was a classics major and is now one of the most influential people in foreign policy and military affairs. He went to Dartmouth. There are a few of them like that, so reach out to him and folks like that. Yes, against the window. Good question. No, there were no women in my platoon. We were an infantry unit, so the way the American military is structured right now, women are not permitted to serve in infantry units. So we were all guys. But there were women in the supporting units, the transportation units, military police, and some of the other supporting units, there were women there. But for the most part, there weren't any American women near us at all. Yes, sir. White shirt. You're wearing a white shirt. Yep. Sorry. That was a good one. Go ahead.
I guess my question is in that position, what
do I think it's right?
Not do you think it's right, but what's the best way to approach that situation?
The best way to approach the situation if somebody's going back for a third or fourth tour? If somebody's going back for a fourth tour like hundreds of thousands of people have, for the most part, they have to go legally. I mean, their options are pretty limited. It's resist and face jail or go. So for them, their options, unfortunately, are pretty limited. But I think for the rest of the American public, I think that it's something we should all be concerned about. I think it's extremely unfair and bad for our society when you've got folks who are serving fourth and fifth tours and most folks are living life uninterrupted and watching American Idol. I think that that is a very skewed dynamic to have. And a lot of folks have said that the volunteer military is good for fighting wars and it's good for the military. And that may be true, but I'm not convinced it's good for our country over time to continue to have this incredible divide that's really unprecedented in American history. So it's something that we're working on every day to try to reduce the number of deployments, and to try to ease the burden on those folks and their families. Because right now it's absolutely, I think, ridiculous and unfair to send folks back for fourth year-long tours. Okay, let's go with a non-military question. How about that? All in the back. Yes, please. Freshman year, I was in Pratt. Okay. Sophomore and junior year, I was at Drew. And senior year, I was at Millikan, which doesn't even exist anymore. It's been knocked down. But that's where I lived. That's where I lived. Who lives in Pratt? Do freshmen still live in Pratt? There we go. Different Pratt now. Different Pratt now. Right. I read about you guys. I mean, there's an impressive bunch of people in this room. I mean, I read interesting facts like someone has invented a bed that there's a patent on. Somebody's 16 years old. There are six more guys than girls in this class, right? I mean, you're an incredibly engaged and important group, and I was really impressed to read about you. Yeah. Up top. Two more? Okay, Tony, President Mark says two more. Yes. I'm sorry? How do I get my news? That's a great question. I am a voracious reader of news, most of it online, but I still like the feel of the New York Times and a paper in my hand. I try to read as many different papers as I can, to include international papers. I constantly read magazines. I read a lot of blogs from war zones and other places. If there's something going on in Iran, I try to get as much first-person information as I can. Look at independent news. But I don't get spoon-fed cable news. I think that, you know, there are outliers that are good. I think PBS is good. I think NPR is good. I think they're, you know, watching NewsHour on PBS is like eating oatmeal with no water or milk in it. But it's really good stuff, and it's good for you. It's good for you. It doesn't go down very easy, but it's really important stuff. So I wish I could shut it off. I'm actually going on vacation after this today for a week, and one of my big challenges is to shut the BlackBerry off and not deal with Twitter and really to disengage. But I would encourage you all to look aggressively for news sources. Don't just take what gets spoon-fed or what's easy, because there is a robust amount of new information and outside the conventional stream information that you can get through the internet that you could have never gotten before. Yes, front row. How have my definitions of patriotism and heroism changed over time? I think they've been refined. I think that they were kind of abstract ideas to me for a while. Patriotism is something that I think folks like me had a very hard time explaining to other people who were listening to folks in Washington who were defining patriotism a certain way. I think patriotism is teaching in an inner city school or writing an op-ed or volunteering in your community. And there are a lot of ways to serve your country far beyond the military. Heroism is even harder. I think it's I hate to say it this way, but you kind of know it when you see it. And it's the same thing. It's not just on the battlefield. I've seen folks in the Gulf region who are heroes every day. I've seen folks like my brother, who I think is a hero. He's an auto mechanic who works double shifts and gets up every day to put food on the table for his family. I think there are heroes that are professors and teachers here at this school, and there are probably heroes among this class. I've read about some of you, and you've come from amazing environments. But heroism is a very tough thing. Heroism is a very tough thing to define. But I think it's something that you all have to be involved in creating the definition for. Don't let someone tell you what patriotism is or someone tell you what heroism is. I think that every day you have an opportunity to sculpt that out for yourself. One more, or is that it? I can't count. I've been up here so long. Okay. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Give me a sec. So I'm going to try to do what may not be possible, which is to embarrass Paul. The two portraits in the room I didn't make reference to. One is Calvin Coolidge there, President of the United States. I'm not going to say much about him, except that he was an alum of the college, and from my reading this summer, more responsible than anyone else for the Great Depression.
Like Lord Jeffrey Amherst. He's going to be a tough one.
But over here on the left is Joseph Nishima, who was lived in Japan at a time when it was a capital offense to leave Japan to learn about the world. And he decided that was unacceptable. He stowed away on a cruiser but left Japan. And when the captain found him, rather than throwing him overboard, which is probably the appropriate thing to do with a stowaway, he talked to him and was impressed. Introduced him to the owner of the steamer, who was an Amherst trustee. Mr. Nishima came to Amherst on full scholarship and went back to Japan after it was no longer a capital offense to learn about the world, to found Doshisha, the greatest and still leading private university in Japan. Nishima, like Paul, took their lives and said, "We will gamble with the ultimate gamble of our lives to learn, to think, serve." You join us tonight. Paul joins us tonight to tell you this is about what you will gamble your lives for. This room is about that. You are surrounded by history of that, and for the next 4 years, in at least 50 different ways, you will be reminded of it. We're honored to have Paul here tonight to start that impression upon you. Paul, thank you.